Hi, everyone, and welcome to the RecTech Pulse. Before we get started, I did want to give you guys a quick heads up. Today's episode will be divided into two parts. So please enjoy the first half of this episode with Hadiya Abdelhadi. And stay tuned for the second part to be released tomorrow morning. Thank you so much for listening in. We hope you enjoy. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the RecTech Pulse. Here with me, I actually have two guests today. I have Teddy Peck, which is one of our key account managers for Acuity. Teddy has been working on the legal sector, which we will be discussing on today's episode. He has been working with legal professionals in the EMEA region, and now we stole them for our region here in the Americas. But we also have our first official guest from outside Acuity. We have Hadiya Abdelhadi. Welcome, Hadiya. Hadiya, for you guys' information, she is the principal attorney at Mass Point, and she has been working with Acuity probably over the past couple of months, right, Hadiya? We've been pulling you in and kind of sharing your knowledge with us probably since May, no?
That's right. We've collaborated now. I think this is our third collaboration in about the same number of months. So it's a pleasure to be back with you.
Amazing. So Hadiya, I'm going to kick it to you really quick. I want you to take a little bit of time to tell us and also our audience about you. What do you do? What's your role at, you know, Mass Point? I know you're also involved with the American Bar Association. So if you can kind of tell us a little bit more about yourself, I think that'd be great.
Okay. Happy to do that. So I am, as you mentioned, principal at Mass Point Strategy Advisory, which is a boutique law and strategy firm. It is my own firm, and it has two components really to the practice. On the one side is regulatory compliance, and in particular for parties and in relation to matters that have some cross-border aspect. So that would include sanctions compliance, anti-money laundering counseling and compliance, and generally good, smart, risk-aware business conduct across borders, involving an international aspect, whether it be a foreign party in the United States or a U.S. party outbound. On the other side, I deal with transactional matters. My practice since I've started has been somewhat unique in that I have split time between transactions and regulatory matters. And on the transactional side, I deal with finance transactions, both conventional and Islamic finance transactions, and occasionally, and I really like when these matters come up, I will deal with matters that have kind of multiple pieces. So there could be a regulatory piece plus a transactional piece, for example, to establish a new philanthropic vehicle where there are multiple issues and legal knowledge areas that might be involved. So that is Mass Point. That, again, is my practice. I'm based out of the Washington, D.C. metro area, out of D.C., where we are all on lockdown pretty much at this point. But that's my practice. And so I've been a lawyer for a number of years. I won't say how many. I've been around for some time and always have split, you know, on the transactional and regulatory side, and that's made the work interesting and I think allowed me to bring a more comprehensive perspective to matters rather than a siloed approach. You mentioned also the ABA. I think you're referring to my membership on the ABA Task Force on Gatekeeper Regulation in the Profession. That is a ABA-wide task force that was established to respond to efforts both nationally and particularly at the multilateral level, that is efforts to regulate lawyers as so-called gatekeepers of the financial system. This is something that comes out of the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, initially, to have lawyers and other non-financial businesses or professions undertake some affirmative obligations with respect to protecting the financial system from financial crime, and in particular, money laundering. And we can talk about that a bit as well. So that is my role on the ABA at the moment. That is something that I've been appointed to serve on that task force. And of course, in this podcast, I have to say that I speak for myself. I don't speak for the ABA. And then finally, in addition to the legal practice and professional activities, I also teach at the George Washington University Law School part-time. So I teach two courses there, one on the regulation of foreign access to U.S. technology, and that is really what we hear about a lot in the news today with the U.S.-China technology race and regulations and actions applicable to entities like Huawei and ZTE and the use of sanctions as well in that area. And then I teach a class, different semesters now, Introduction to Transactional Islamic Law. And so that's the Islamic banking, finance, contracts piece. So that's a class I enjoy very much. I enjoy both of them. So that is what I do professionally in a nutshell.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here today. Obviously, Teddy, I'm going to also give you time to talk. I know I kind of introduced you, but is there anything else that you want to bring to the table? I don't want to leave you left out, obviously.
My goodness. No, I look after our law firms. I look after law firms across the US and have looked after law firms in the UK. Primarily, it's to do with them being concerned about, you know, what do they need to do when they're checking their clients. And so in the US, you find that tends to be AML groups or conflicts teams. And in the UK, it's kind of business acceptance and conflicts teams and AML teams. It's a little bit more excessive over in the UK than it is in the US. But that's me in a nutshell.
Well, thank you both so much for being here. I mean, you guys have been exposed to this because one of the things that we'll be discussing today, and you kind of mentioned this earlier, but it's around, you know, the legal sector. We know it differs from region to region, from country to country due to regulations. So, but I am very excited because Hideo, you have a lot of knowledge. You're an expert. You have been practicing for quite a while. And this is an area that we focus here at Acuity. And we are, you know, constantly trying to explore. So thank you for being here. So as we kick things in, I mentioned earlier, you did a panel with us around sanctions. You also did a piece in the Ask the Expert blog that we published not long ago here at Acuity. And during the blog, you briefly mentioned lawyers being involved in the fight against financial crime. So can you elaborate on that a little bit more as we get things going?
Sure. Yes. So we did the Q&A with Acuity, and that was a nice exercise. And I thought the Acuity team really did come up with great questions. So I have to, again, say that because good questions get, I hope, good answers. But one of the questions was about the role of lawyers in the fight against financial crime. And financial crime, of course, can mean a number of activities, illicit activities. Anti-money laundering or money laundering is the one that usually comes to mind first, but it can be a number of things. Corrupt activities, proceeds of corruption that are running through the financial system. Could be sanctions evasion, tax evasion, human trafficking, trafficking in wildlife. That's getting more attention these days. So lawyers can play a number of roles. There are lawyers who are, I would say, on the front lines, whether they are prosecutors at a national level, whether they are involved, say, with an organization like the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, with the OECD, lawyers that work in multilateral institutions like the World Bank, where they deal with these issues, particularly corruption issues, in their procurement and in other ways. The IMF, where there are lawyers in the legal department who are dealing with counseling countries in the context of IMF consultations on anti-money laundering regulation, effective anti-money laundering regulation. And of course, there are lawyers and compliance personnel who are not lawyers in financial institutions and elsewhere who are on the front lines in terms of identifying, that is the detection piece, responding to, deterring, stopping financial crime. So there is a range of roles that lawyers can play, and those are just a few of the roles. But it all depends on what the lawyer is doing and what environment the lawyer is operating. In private practice, really, it really would depend on what the lawyer has chosen. Someone like me, who is in a counseling and compliance counseling role for clients, whether it be to develop a program or in connection with a particular matter or transaction, my role would be somewhat indirect in that I am helping the client to comply with the law, helping the client to avoid vendors or third parties who themselves may be engaged in financial crime or pose a risk in some way. So some are directly involved, some are indirect. And of course, there are lawyers who are on the side of defense. And that's, of course, something that we need in our system as well when people are accused of financial crime and of other conduct that might entangle them with the law. So the roles vary, and they vary in this country and internationally.
What do you think has changed throughout your career in those kind of aspects? Do you notice a particularly big change in one certain part, or they're all just developing all the time?
With respect to financial crime?
Yeah.
Well, I would say that there is probably more awareness, although I'm not sure how widespread the awareness is. You know, my background is when I started practicing out of law school, I worked with a law firm that was a Houston-based firm. It was a large firm with offices overseas. I was part of an international group. And I was involved in that firm, both in work that I do now, you know, on the transactional and on the regulatory side. And it was interesting for me because when I was very junior, I think maybe I'd been 2 years out of law school at that point, I became involved in a matter under the then new USA Patriot Act. You'll remember the Patriot Act was passed within a month or so of 9/11. And that was a major amendment to the Bank Secrecy Act, which was the principal AML anti-financial crime law. And so I became involved in that because there were a number of clients of the particular practice I was in, or matters, I should say, where there were issues that came up both for financial institutions in terms of the Patriot Act and the Bank Secrecy Act as amended, but also for the customers, for the clients. These were people who were high net worth. Some of them were politically exposed persons. That's the language of FATF. Some of them were members of ruling families or royal families. And so there were issues that came up for those clients. And then there were issues that came up, of course, for financial institutions. So that was my first exposure early after the passage of the Patriot Act and while I was still a new lawyer. And then I got further involved because I happened to be seconded to a bank here in the United States for a few months that was subject to one of the first major high-profile Patriot Act enforcement actions. And it's interesting to think about that now because at the time it was big news. Of course, this was shortly after, or not long after 9/11, I should say. This bank was well known for a certain cachet that it had. I won't mention the name of the bank, but I do remember at the time becoming familiar with the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network at FinCEN, that's at the Treasury Department. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency was involved. It was a big news item, and I was a young lawyer, as I mentioned, and it exposed me in that work to the anti-corruption aspects because there were issues with, you know, politically exposed persons and other government-affiliated parties, let's say. And the fine or the penalty that was imposed on that bank, the monetary penalty, was about $25 million, which at that time was a really big deal. And of course, today, that's kind of walking around money, right? If you look at that and you look at the penalties that we see in these types of enforcement actions. So that's kind of my own personal entree into the area a long time ago and dealing with different parties who had been exposed to these new and stricter regulations aimed at money laundering in particular, and of course, counterterrorism financing. So I do think there's more awareness. The issues of AML, anti-corruption, these have grown as practice areas for lawyers, particularly in private practice. There has been greater enforcement activity, say, with the Department of Justice and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This is related to financial crime, of course. So there have been changes. There has been a kind of industry or within the legal industry, a practice burgeoning that's occurred. And I think it will remain with us. That being said, I think maybe when we get later in this conversation to the issue of where we're going in the United States, you know, we have a lot of lawyers in this country, and a lot of lawyers don't deal with these issues that I've just talked about. You know, this is not a widespread practice. And so I think we still have a ways to go in terms of awareness and education for the legal profession and for others.
Well, whilst you say that, you know, there's lots of lawyers across the US and they don't have awareness or they don't have much dealings with that type of practice. Do you see that being a challenge or an issue for firms or for the wider community as a whole?
Well, you know, I have to give it some more thought, but I would say yes and no. On the one hand, you know, there are lawyers, you know, the majority of lawyers practicing are solo or small firm lawyers. And they may not necessarily be involved with matters or with parties who carry with them, whether it's because of their activity or their orbit, that the clients and matters and jurisdictions where they're located may not carry the kind of risk, let's say, that we might be concerned about in the anti-money laundering area, or let's say with certain real estate transactions, which are scrutinized more and more in this country. And we can talk about that. But I do think that for the segment of lawyers that are in jurisdictions where there are risks or engage in transactions, whether it be trust formation, entity formation, real estate transactions, other transactional work, that there probably is a need for education. I don't know that, you know, lawyers, and they really wouldn't have reason to, would think about their anti-money laundering, I won't say obligations, but that they may intersect with that area. I don't know that that's on the minds of many practitioners, and I can't speak for them, of course, but I don't think that that would be something that would naturally occur to a lawyer unless it's something that he or she encounters in practice or through some other avenue. Although I will say as well that regulators, enforcement authorities have gotten a lot more creative, let's say, in their enforcement. You know, in the Q&A with Acuity that I did, it was a two-part, and I think it was in the first part, I mentioned that OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control at the Treasury Department, which enforces sanctions, has made it very clear through enforcement actions and through statements that sanctions compliance is expected across industries. You know, it's not just in industries, let's say, from the financial institutions or from, you know, high risk or very international industries. So there have been cases recently where, you know, there have been personal services, say, under life insurance and health insurance policies, where the person receiving the benefit of that was a specially designated national. Now, you know, I don't think that this would occur to the person on the insurance company side, that they may be dealing with someone who is a blocked person for sanctions purposes in the context of a personal life insurance policy. So, you know, that's talking about how the regulators have behaved and how wide the net has been cast in some cases. And so I think lawyers need to mirror that, but only where it's appropriate. We can't have also burdens imposed where there's no reason to impose such a burden. And I think the FATF recommendations and considerations about lawyer regulation reflect that. It's not across the board. It's where it's needed. It's risk-based.
And I can also see that, and when you talk about this, it's mostly too on the area of law that you practice too, I'm assuming. I don't think that someone that's practicing, you know, family law should even care, right? I would think, no, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, it would depend also on the kind of family law. I mean, there are some family law cases you can, you know, if you think about some of the kind of indicia, let's say some of the fact patterns that might lead one to conduct due diligence, whether it's a financial institution or not. You can have a family law case that involves high net worth individuals or politically exposed persons, or what we call under the USA, under the US law, senior foreign political officials. So it would depend on who's involved, what kind of assets are involved. Could there be, for example, efforts in a family law context, let's say a divorce, where there is an effort to avoid obligations, to conceal assets, for example. So I think it would depend. But if it's an average, you know, where we, most of us would encounter in a family law situation where there are assets involved, financial transactions involved, where assets are traceable, where the source of the asset can be readily identified, we probably wouldn't have an issue. So I wouldn't say as a category that any one area of law should be disregarded, certainly in non-litigation contexts. But of course, some areas are riskier than others. So family law wouldn't be at the top of that list of risk, but certainly there could be scenarios within that area that would require some diligence on the part of a lawyer or others involved.
Right. You know, it's so funny you mentioned that. I have a funny story. We attended a trade show and, you know, for my educational purposes, I decided to go and, you know, be a part of the conversations. And I remember one of the lawyers came up to us and she said, well, you know, I just don't understand why I would need to do any type of screening. I do family law. Facebook is that's how I do my due diligence. I found it kind of funny because, you know, I see lawyers now rely a lot on social media, Google, and like public resources for them to check information. But it just kind of stood out to me that she mentioned that too. So,
well, yeah, I think there are a lot of information sources. You know, law enforcement, of course, uses social media. This administration that we have right now wants to screen social media of people seeking to enter the United States to make decisions about entry. So certainly social media is an avenue. I know people who, you know, I was talking to a colleague recently who had mentioned someone to me who could be a prospective client, and he said, well, I looked the guy up on LinkedIn. He looks legitimate. So, you know, people do use that. But, you know, I think, again, depending on the kind of work that one is doing as a lawyer or frankly in another capacity, you know, you want to try to avail yourself of resources that are appropriate to the potential risk. And sometimes there is no risk or no apparent risk, let's say.
And this might seem like a little bit of a simple question, but if you were going to explain in terms of what it means to the lawyer and what it means to their firm, you know, why should they personally in their firm really care about these kinds of risks, these financial crime risks? What could it mean to them? I wondered whether you could just go into that in a bit of detail.
Well, I think there are different levels that I would think about this as a lawyer. Number one, let's talk about the client and the client's interests. I think it is useful, even if not engaged directly in this area, or let's say in a high risk area, I think it would be useful to a lawyer to familiarize himself or herself or a firm with these areas, because you're counseling clients not only about their immediate risk or the risk of their own conduct, but also, let's say, in the context of businesses, the business's exposure to third parties, to counterparties. There have been cases where, let's say, a company that is engaged in a commercial transaction or a commercial line of business might become entangled in a financial crime risk, such as having their bank account frozen or having a transaction frozen and being unable to get payment, let's say, from a party, because that party carries with it a financial crime risk. And so navigating particularly transactions for a client, especially clients that are, you know, engaged in a regular business, and certainly if there's any kind of international component, that is a foreign party in the United States or some kind of cross-border transaction, I think it's helpful to know that so that you can counsel your client and, you know, address things that may not have been part of the design of the matter that the lawyer is working on. So that's, I think, good for general lawyering purposes, particularly where it is relevant. Again, it's not for someone who has nothing to do with financial crime risk. So it's risk-based. So as far as effective lawyering goes, I think it's good for many lawyers to have that kind of information and awareness. There is also an interest on the part of the lawyer, not only in complying with the rules of professional conduct, and we can talk about that, but also mitigating the lawyer's own risk, because lawyers, there's a reputational issue, of course. setting aside any breaches of rules. But there's a reputational issue. A lawyer wants to maintain a reputation, not only for not being involved in such conduct, but also for being competent enough to recognize that conduct in a timely fashion. And it doesn't mean that, you know, we are not all susceptible to being entangled in that, but there's a way of reacting as well. So I think that professionals, legal professionals, others would want to make sure that they can detect that to maintain their own reputation, to satisfy their own professional conduct obligations, and also to not have, for example, an issue with their own professional indemnity insurance. Okay, so there are some very practical issues to take into consideration. Another area for lawyers in particular is with client trust accounts. The way that lawyers are regulated in the United States and the way that we handle client funds is that we maintain client trust accounts. Some of those are specific to a client and some are pooled trust accounts. They are called IOLTA accounts, and that's an interest on lawyers trust account. So this is for deposits of funds that are expected to be maintained on a short-term basis, where any interest goes to, let's say, the local bar foundation. Okay, it's for charitable purposes. And there, you know, a lawyer should be careful with funds from the client, because you don't want to inadvertently have, you know, funds that are the proceeds of corruption or otherwise objectionable or problematic deposited into that client trust account, particularly a pooled account, because the bank has less visibility as to that account. The bank is operating or looking that account through the lawyer intermediaries who are transacting on that account. And so that's a real issue. And that's something that came up recently in the last few years, I should say, in connection with the 1MDB scandal. That's the Malaysian Sovereign Wealth Fund. I don't know if you followed this, but there were some reports about funds that had been deposited into trust accounts, and there were some questions around those funds. I'll just put it that way. So that's an area for lawyers to be concerned about as well.
Thanks for listening to part one of this episode. We hope you enjoyed it, but please stay tuned for the second part, which will be released tomorrow at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks.